This is Emmy DeGrappa with Think Why Radio, brought to you by the Wyoming Humanities Council, expanding our horizons through critical and creative thinking. Find us online at thinkwhy.org. Today, we are talking to John Byrne Cook, who was Janis Joplin's first and only road manager from 1967 until her death from a heroin overdose in 1970. Welcome, John.
Good to be here.
Tell us about this recent memoir and why you thought it was important to put it out there so far after her death in 1970.
Well, there were a number of books over the years, and even immediately after she died or years after she died, I wasn't considering that it would be inevitable that I would write a book. But two things. One, the picture that emerged from a number of the books was, in my view, woefully incomplete. And there came a point when I realized that I had a story to tell, not only that nobody else had told, but could tell, because no one else who wrote a book was traveling on the road with Janis and her various bands over the course of those 3 years. That's where her life was, you know. Her life was performing on tour. And there were books by people who had known her in San Francisco and books by people who didn't know her at all but did a lot of research. Anyway, I realized that I had a story to tell. And actually, starting in the mid to late 90s, I tried to sell this book in a couple of slightly different versions. Didn't sell it then, put it aside, and then 6 or 8 years ago, my girlfriend said, "You really have to get back to the Janis book."
And why is it different now than it was then?
Well, for one thing, you know, I have published, starting in the mid-80s, 3 historical novels of the American West, and I did a very different kind of book in 2007. So after I had originally started writing the Janis memoir, I did a book in the aughts, which was my first book of nonfiction, but totally removed from my life and my experience, called Reporting the War, about freedom of the press in wartime, in all the American wars, a historical survey kind of work. Why did I think it was important to do it now? Mm-hmm. What I did that was different this time, and it would be my preferred way of selling every book if I could afford it and had the time, I wrote the whole book before I showed it to publishers. As I say, when I tried to sell it in the 90s, there were a couple of different versions. One of them leaned more heavily on my life before I knew Janis, and so that became the latter part of the book. But I realized I focused on the story that I had to tell about Janis Joplin, which was her life on the road. And that became the book. And when I was clear about the structure and the idea of the book, I wrote the whole book before I showed it to my agent and to publishers, and we sold it on the basis of that. It's funny, because at some point I had to pretend that I hadn't quite written the whole book. But once we got the publishing deal and I told my editor, she was perfectly happy that we had the whole book written.
That's convenient. How was it that you were the one and only road manager for Janis Joplin?
Well, you know, I wasn't intending that it was going to be an indefinite career. I had been a musician playing bluegrass and old-time music starting early in the 60s in the great folk boom, and had a wonderful time based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We knew the folks in Greenwich Village. We knew the folks in Berkeley. It was a small family and a lot of good people, and from that group, many of my lifetime friendships were drawn. And because of those connections, I got the opportunity to road manage Janis. There was not a reserve of experienced road managers in the late 60s. Big Brother and Janis made a stupendous impression at the Monterey Pop Festival in June 1967. And as a result of that, and the fact that Albert Grossman, who was Bob Dylan's manager, managed a lot of great folk acts and was getting into rock acts, was present at the Monterey Pop Festival and actually was called on for advice by Janis and Big Brother, As a result of those interactions and the impression that Big Brother made at the Pop Festival, Albert signed to manage them 3 or 4 months later when they fired their local San Francisco manager. And Albert is the person who hired me to road manage them, not because I had any experience, but because a mutual friend told him I could learn on the job and do it. And the expectation was that it would be Janice, Big Brother and the Holding Company, and it was billed strictly as Big Brother and the Holding Company, not Janis Joplin and or with. You know, she was a member of that band. That band existed before she was with them. They brought her into the band, and she and the band achieved their greatest success together. The impression at Monterey, the album Cheap Thrills, which went gold in the first week that it was released. What I didn't expect, and I think very few other people expected, was that she decided in the late summer of 1968 to leave Big Brother that fall when their contracted gigs had been played, and to try to do something new and actually more difficult, which was to be the star, to be the singer in the spotlight with a backup band, which was modeled for her by a couple of contemporary women that she hugely admired, you know, Tina Turner, Aretha Franklin, Irma Franklin. I think she saw that as a fascinating and daunting challenge. And once you see the challenge, if you're a certain type of personality, which Janice was, she couldn't not do it, because she always would have wondered, could I have met the challenge? Could I have done it? Could I have succeeded like that on my own? So she finished playing the gigs with Big Brother, and she formed a new band. And that band lasted for about a year, and was ultimately not a success. And then she took 6 months off. Nobody knew what was going to happen after that. I was doing other things during that time. And in the spring of 1970, she formed another band, and that one was a big success. And she expected to play with them indefinitely into the future. So I stayed with her through those second and third bands, the Cosmic Blues Band and Full Tilt Boogie in 69 and 70.
What does it mean to be a road manager?
There is a manager, which is what Albert Grossman's job was, and he had an office in New York, 2 floors of a townhouse on East 55th Street, and he had people answering the phones. He had an attorney, he had an accountant, he had, you know, those and other various people who are managing a number of bands, and they are talking to promoters, they're booking tours, they're making the contracts. All of that stuff is done in the management office. The road manager, as the term implies, is out on the road. And the idea basically is that the musicians only have to think about music. The road manager handles the logistics, and he handles getting paid. So the musicians wake up in the morning when I wake them up, and we get in the rental car, we go to the airport, we get in a plane, we land, we get another rental car, we check into another hotel or motel. We do a sound check, we perform the gig, and I go to the box office and get paid, and then the cycle repeats. And when you're touring heavily, there are times you don't know where you are. You know, what town is this? Because you're just, you know, you land, it's another hotel, another rental car, another gig.
Yeah, oh, I bet. What was it like to travel with Janice? What was her personality?
Well, she was, you know, the two things I always say, because they're not what people expect, is she was very smart and she was often very funny. In the beginning, it was Big Brother and the Holding Company. There was Janice and there were 4 guys. And I had a clearer impression of Janice before I started doing the job, because she had made such an amazing debut at the Monterey Pop Festival. So I was getting to know 5 people. I mean, I knew her as this dynamic singer on stage, which is the first impression almost everybody had of Janice. But I had 4 other guys to get to know, and they were a co-equal band. They voted, you know, they all made decisions by voting. Everybody had an equal say. And it was fascinating because a couple of them had advanced degrees. You know, they were not at all what I expected. Only one of them came out of the folk boom. It was a very interesting group of people. And I, as I said, I had been playing music myself, but the folk music had evolved into folk rock and then rock and roll, and I was not one of those guitar players who picked up an electric guitar. So for me, I was looking for what came next. And I thought I would find my work, and I consciously took the job of road managing as a transitional job. And privately, to myself, not to Albert Grossman, not to Big Brother and the Holding Company, I said, I will do this job for 6 months and see where we are at that time and see if I am closer to finding my own work. And at the end of 6 months, I liked these people. I liked the members of Big Brother and the Holding Company, all of them unique individuals, and I was, at that point, glad to keep on doing it. And 6 months from when I took the job, it was only 2 or 3 months later that Janice decided to leave Big Brother, and at that time she said to me, I would like it if you would come with me with the new band. And it wasn't clear that Big Brother would continue performing anyway, so... You know, that's where the job went. And besides, my, you know, I loved the guys in Big Brother, but Janice was at that point leaving them and going into the unknown and trying to do something obviously that was going to be difficult, and it seemed to me that she needed all the help she could get. So I was happy to keep on doing my job to make it possible for her to do hers in the new context.
You became friends. You weren't just someone who worked for her. You actually became a friend with her. She trusted you.
Oh, totally. I suspect that in other bands, I suppose, I mean, our concept of road managers in the early to mid-60s, Bob Dylan showed up with a road manager. We thought, what? A folk artist with a road manager? Jazz bands have road managers. I mean, I suppose there are contexts in which a road manager is just an employee. But within Big Brother, and specifically Janice, Janice never worked with anybody for long who was just an employee. There was some degree, considerable degree of friendship. There had to be a personal relationship. And all friendship has some degree of love. And I loved those guys. And Janice wanted to be with people that she loved and who loved her in some measure. And that's the way it was in our groups on the road. That's one of the reasons the Cosmic Blues Band, that first band that she formed to go out on her own, ultimately failed, because that feeling, I won't say it never gelled, it did gel briefly on her only European tour. When the Cosmic Blues Band was only 3 or 4 months old, and it was a whopping success, and the band gelled over there, but it didn't hold when we came back to the States. It was a large band. There were 7 musicians, something like that, and disparate personalities, and it never really came together in a way where Janice felt like it was a cohesive group, a unity that she was part of, and that's part of the reason that she and Albert Grossman decided to let that band expire at the end of 1969.
How old was she when she died?
27.
Oh, my gosh. Were you at all aware that she was that deep into drugs?
Well, she wasn't very deep at that time. I was totally aware that she was, in the Big Brother year, it was occasional. In 69, with Cosmic Blues, because things were so difficult, because... Before we were very far along, she felt the potential for failure, which made her more and more nervous. And as we got farther along, the likelihood of failure seemed greater and greater. And she took that on herself. She felt that she was failing. And that was the year that was the hardest for her. That was the year where her use of drugs and alcohol was the worst, and sometimes visibly, to me anyway, affecting her performances. And I actually quit before the end of that tour because it wasn't fun anymore. So I was off the road longer than 6 months. At the end of Cosmic Blues, Janice was off the road for 6 months. And for her, that was a huge difference from when she left Big Brother. When she left Big Brother, she knew what came next. She knew what she was going to do. And when that effort failed at the end of 69, she did not know what came next. And so as she approached the last months of Cosmic Blues, that's what's on her mind, failure. And because of that, and because of the drug abuse and her general, you know, depression and not feeling good about herself, that's why I left the road. And what it took to bring me back was reports from Albert Grossman and other mutual friends that, A, she had kicked her drug habit, B, she was absolutely full of energy, and that she and Albert had put together a backup band that they both loved and thought was going to be hugely successful, and we're going to have fun now, you've got to come back on the road. And eventually, I believed the message, and I flew back out. And she was a completely transformed woman, not just because she had a new band and she was happy. She had learned, this was the great thing about Janice, and for me, this is the critical element to her story. She had learned all the lessons of the really hard times in 1969, the failure of the Cosmic Blues Band. This is where her intelligence comes into play. She had learned the lessons, and she had processed them, as we would say now. And in the first couple of weeks we were on tour with the Full Tilt Boogie Band, I saw this changed woman who was on top of a lot of stuff that she just either wouldn't deal with before. I mean, her relationship with Albert Grossman was more complex and totally in a totally positive way. She believed there was going to be money left after all the expenses of touring and paying the musicians and everybody got their cut. She had faith in the future and her own future. And she had thought about it all and she could articulate the things that were different. And it was, she was this transformed woman. It was a joyful time. It was at least as happy as those first and middle months of touring with Big Brother when everything was just up.
What changes between the book and the film that you're also introducing?
While I was traveling with Big Brother early in 1968, and I began the 1st of December, 67, when we came east, after a couple of months of pretty much touring only in California, I was learning the job and they were learning what it was like to be under Albert Grossman's management, I bought a movie camera. And so I'm shooting 8mm film. And I'm shooting silent 8mm film. And what I would do when we got home from a tour is I would cut the film, which in those days meant literally cutting it with a splicing device. And I had picture, that's what I had, and I would cut it for the picture. What story can the picture tell? And then I would put on a record, you know, Janet, Big Brother's, once we had the Cheap Thrills album, I'd put on, and I would just play various bands of the record and see what kind of worked with the movie. And eventually I got to pick what song, and I made soundtracks on an audio cassette, and I would play it while I was projecting the movie, you know, it was very crude, but it worked. And since I've been able to edit film in my computer, I've been able to make the relationships a lot more precise. So I, over the course of those 3 years, I continued shooting film. And because she played with three bands in 3 years, I cut separate films of the year with Big Brother, the year with Cosmic Blues, and the year with Full Tilt Boogie. And I have a couple of those run from 15 to 24 minutes. And the films, all of my edited films together are 70 minutes, an hour and 10 minutes. And what I do when I show them is I introduce each film in less than 5 minutes. It's just like a little narrative link to tie them together. And I don't talk about Janice's evolution in the way that I have this wonderful opportunity here to talk with you, but somehow it comes through in the film. I mean, I did not edit these films to present a certain view of Janice. In fact, I used at least 70 or 75% of all the footage I shot. I mean, I was a road manager. I had a 24-hour day job. But I did have this little Fuji 8mm camera, you know. And when I could take some film, I'd shoot some film. And I'm glad I've got every minute of film that I've got. But what I did, in other words, I wasn't editing out Janice down, Janice shooting up. I mean, of course, I didn't, you know, I didn't live in the closet of Janice's bedroom. I didn't see who she was going to bed with. I didn't see what she was doing when she retired to her room after a gig. I shot on stage and off stage, traveling out there in the world. And somehow, in these films, you get a feeling for Janis Joplin that, without reading my book, it would add to your understanding of Janis Joplin. And I say that with a lot of confidence, precisely because 4 years ago, I showed these movies here in Jackson at the Center for the Arts, again, first time, as a benefit for the Jackson Hole Writers Conference, which we're doing again this time. And at least half a dozen people came up to me in the days and weeks that followed and said almost exactly the same thing. I mean, I was astonished every time because this same reaction kept coming up. They would say, man, those movies gave me a whole other level of understanding of Janis Joplin. And to a filmmaker, that's, you don't get any better award than that. You know, that's like the Oscar. And I'm, you know, the fact that I could shoot silent film, I can create soundtracks entirely out of recorded music by Janis and her bands. And you get that from these films just makes me very happy.
That sounds wonderful. I can't wait to see them. Where did your life journey go after Janis's death? What did you do with your music and your writing? And
in the time after I quit Cosmic Blues, and I was off the road for 7 or 8 months, one of the reasons I left was because a mutual friend of Janice's and mine, Bob Neuwirth, had an idea for kind of a off-the-wall, independent feature film that we were going to shoot in 16 millimeter. We both had worked with D.A. Pennybaker, Don Pennybaker, who was, we were both on the crew of the film that filmed the Monterey Pop Festival. And we had both worked with Penny and his partner, Ricky Leacock, both great filmmakers in their own right, and a particular concept of shooting film. And Bob had an idea and actually went so far as to talk to Albert Grossman and Janis, and to talk to Michael J. Pollard, whom he had met shortly after Michael J. Pollard came out and got the world's attention in Bonnie and Clyde. And we had letters of intent from Janis and Michael J. Pollard that if we got funding for the film, they would be in it. We were going to shoot it in Paris. We were going to fly to Paris and shoot 16 millimeter film on the streets of Paris without bothering about permits for shooting in the street. It was going to be gonzo filmmaking. And to help attract financing, Bob needed some kind of an outline, some kind of a script. And I got my hands on a genuine Hollywood screenplay, so I could see the format and the style. And I wrote a sort of a partial outline and a partial screenplay. And we used those to try to get financing. And we never did. We had the Italian director Marco Ferreri offered us $20,000, and we got our budget down to $70,000, and we never could quite close that gap, you know?
Oh, jeez.
I mean, imagine going out and making a film for... So well, that was to get us up to, you know, to where we had a print from which we could get more money to make release prints and to distribute. But but this was the concept of filmmaking. We every time we get together and we talk about it, we say, man, if we'd made that movie, we'd be millionaires. So that was the beginning of writing. I had written as a kid. I had learned how to type at an early age, and I would, I don't know, I made up stories. Sometimes I would see a movie. I love movies. See a movie, and I would kind of write the story of the movie in my own prose, you know. But this is what got me back into writing. After Janice died, what really got me lined out for my novels was coming to Wyoming. Because through the Bay Area music scene, through the Grateful Dead in particular, I met John Perry Barlow, who was a Wyoming rancher, a son of a Wyoming ranch, who went to high school with Bob Weir of the Grateful Dead in Colorado. And was connected with Weir Ever After, and at a certain point began writing lyrics for songs that Bob Weir wrote, and was on his way to California basically to join the Grateful Dead family when he stopped at his family ranch in Wyoming. And his father had had a stroke, and his father died, and John took over the running of the ranch and ran it for a little over 20 years, which was longer than anybody thought he could. So because of that connection through the music, in the mid-70s, I came to the Barcross Ranch in Cora, Wyoming. And the experience of Wyoming and the horses and the cattle on a working ranch catalyzed an idea that I had for a movie. It was a screenplay first. It was a Western screenplay about the Indian Wars in the 1870s. I moved to LA. I got some jobs as a screenwriter. Didn't sell. It was going to be a very expensive movie. Shooting in winter is very expensive. But at a certain point, decided to write that story as a novel, and that became my first novel.
What was the name of that?
The Snowblind Moon.
The Snowblind Moon.
The moon of snowblindness we have just passed through. It's roughly the month of March. It's when the Plains Indians, the Lakota Sioux in particular, would have exhausted their supply of meat that they laid up in the fall. So the hunters have to go out to try to find meat while the snow is still on the ground and the days are getting longer. You go through the equinox and the hunters are subject to snowblindness from hunting in the bright spring sun, reflecting off the snow.
I have one last question. Who is your father?
My father is Alistair Cook, who Americans know as, well, we now have a generation, a young generation that does not know him as the introducer of Masterpiece Theater. But for more than 20 years, he was a term he loathed, a television personality. And before that, for a generation as old as my parents, he became a television personality in the early 50s. From 1953 to 61, there was a program on network television called Omnibus on Sunday afternoon, an hour and a half program. Never been anything like it before or after. Omnibus means for everyone. And they would do, I guess now you'd call it a magazine show. The term didn't even apply. But they might do several segments of different things, or they might take the entire time to do a play, for instance, and it was live television. There was no takes, there was no tape, and there was no retakes, you know. And it was so he became known for those things because on television you have a public face. But what he was a journalist. And that's what it says on my birth certificate. And for almost 30 years, he filed a daily piece for when he began writing for them, the British paper, the Manchester Guardian, which after 7 or 8 years became simply the Guardian and moved their base of operations from Manchester, England to London. And he also was a radio broadcaster, and he did a program beginning in 1946 called Letter from America. It was a 15-minute broadcast once a week, and it became the longest-running weekly broadcast in the history of radio. And he would talk from America to England and to the British Empire, to the rest of the world, about America, about anything he wanted to do. So this was his work. These were the jobs that he got himself. And for The Guardian, he was doing the same thing. He was reporting from America to the rest of the world, and he had done that before either of those specific jobs, but during the war he was reporting for the BBC. And never more important than right after Pearl Harbor, because the British had been holding the line against Nazi Germany alone for 2 years. And when we got in the war, it was very important that they know that we were really in the war. And he was going around the country reporting on how every city, every region was affected by the war and how it was contributing to the war effort. So this is really his life's work, is interpreting America, explaining America, elucidating America for Britain and the rest of the world.
That is so fascinating. He influenced your life, didn't he?
Yeah, but I never, I mean, I really didn't, into my 20s, even into my 30s, I didn't think of following in his footsteps. If I had followed in my father's footsteps, I would have become a journalist, which would not have been a bad idea, because journalism is a great way to learn to write good copy to mm-hmm. deadline. And I was writing novels. You see, he didn't, I think he read a good deal of fiction when he was young. And he certainly read my first novel. But again, if I were following in my father's footsteps, I would have been a reporter or a historian writing nonfiction. But I eventually came to that. But before I wrote my first book of nonfiction, at some point I was with him, and just on a whim, I said, "Do you think the ability to write is genetically transmitted?" And he said, and this was very untypical of him because he wasn't egotistical. He said, "I hope so."
That's great.
I thought that was a good answer. I hope so, too.
I hope so.
Well, he wrote clearly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, good. Thank you so much for your time. Thanks for all the stories and information you shared with us.
My pleasure entirely. Thank you, Emmy.
This is Emmy DeGrappa with Think Why Radio, brought to you by the Wyoming Humanities Council, expanding our horizons through critical and creative thinking. Find us online at thinkwhy.org.